Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
Cool. Great. Well, welcome everybody, and very warm welcome to Dr. Michael Shea, who's talking to us from Florida. And we've had Michael on our platform quite a few times in the past, but not for a couple of years, I think, now. Michael's going to be talking about his view of the polyvagal theory, which he calls the multivagal. And Michael has been an educator in the field of somatic work and craniosacral work for many years, has also written several volumes on craniosacral therapy and biodynamic craniosacral therapy. And I first met Michael when I assisted with him in one of his many seminars in London. And he obviously teaches all over the world as well, his wonderful work and his wonderful approach to craniosacral therapy. So welcome, Michael. Thank you for being here today. Thank you.
Oh, John, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate going into the Wayback Machine and remembering those early days now that my entire schedule got canceled last year and everybody's doing Zoom. I'm going through these wonderful reflections of everywhere I've been and all the wonderful people I've met. And I just can't tell you how much I appreciate being in relationship with you and just seeing you again. It just warms my heart. So thank you.
That's lovely. They're really lovely to see you. Thank you.
We've got about an hour, and I've got some introductions that I'd like to do regarding the model that I've developed called the multivagal model. So I'm going to do a little bit of a review when we get to the anatomy presentation, because I'm assuming I'm not preaching to the, or that I am actually preaching to the choir that most of you are going to be familiar with the polyvagal model. So I want to give a shout out to Stephen Porges. I've been on the dais with him in several conferences, but I met Stephen when he was actually developing his polyvagal model. I was a member of the Rolf Institute back in the early 80s, and Stephen was actually on the research committee of the Rolf Institute. And so I was aware of the direction he was going with the autonomic nervous system and the vagus nerve. And then when the whole thing, you know, broke open in the late 80s and 1990s, it was just fascinating to be there and be present and to study that model from the very beginning. So I guess the one question we should answer right away, well, what's the difference between the polyvagal model and the model that I'm going to be presenting, the multivagal model? And basically, I'm going to be integrating Stephen's material, which I call above the diaphragm, with all the research and work that I've done with the vagus nerve and the autonomic nervous system below the diaphragm. And not to say that Stephen hasn't gone in that direction, because there was a wonderful article about a year or so ago that came out where the polyvagal model was starting to be integrated with what was going on below the level of the diaphragm. So at any rate, I've talked to Stephen about this model, and he likes the direction it's going. I've had my hands on Stephen. He walks his talk. And I'd like to have this model that I'm presenting to you be actually a part of his model, but as a tribute to him. I think we really have to acknowledge the shoulders we stand on as teachers. And he's a great teacher, a great human being. So thank you for that. Just a couple of words here as I look at my notes. We are now in the age, we could say, of fear. There's a lot of fear of COVID. There's a lot of fear around politics and all the different dynamics that are going on in our culture right now. And I think the vagus model, the multivagal model, and especially the way Stephen presents it, is primarily a model of safety and discerning safety. And that means discerning fear. And discerning defensiveness. And when we get below the level of the diaphragm, that discernment of safety changes to an internal dynamic, and it changes into an internal metabolic dynamic in terms of how the vagus nerve functions below the level of the diaphragm. So in this series that we're going to be doing, this being the introduction, and we've got three pieces following up on this, we're really going to be investigating the differences between the physiological components associated with the vagus nerve and the metabolic components. We now live in the age of metabolism. 88% of Americans are now metabolically unhealthy. Research came out last week that indeed, because Americans are so metabolically unhealthy, we now know that COVID really essentially kills the majority of people that die from COVID are actually comorbid conditions with metabolic challenges underneath, 94%. So it's important that we have an understanding of how this vagus nerve functions, because the vagus nerve below the level of the diaphragm knows everything that's going on with our metabolism. It knows blood glucose levels. It knows what's going on with insulin. It knows what's going on with every single organ. And in particular, it knows what's going on with inflammation. So all of that we're going to be discussing over our time together, and how safety is generated regarding that. Now, there's terminology regarding the vagus nerve that I think many of us already know, and the three principal terms that I'm assuming most everybody knows, but I will review them, are vagal tone. Our heartbeat is supposed to beat at 70 beats per minute. And to keep our heartbeat at 70, or to return the heartbeat to 70 beats after it's gotten accelerated from a sympathetic charge, so to speak, we're going to need really good vagal tone. And that vagal tone is also a marker of heart rate variability. And without getting into a long explanation or trying to define heart rate variability, I just like to say every heartbeat is different. And that's measurable in terms of frequencies and so forth, and the whole electromagnetic field of the heart. But we know that Stephen Porges is the one that named heart rate variability. He's kind of the king of heart rate variability. Actually, he's the king of the vagus, and he's the prince of heart rate variability, I guess we could say. But very important to understand heart rate variability, because it is a marker for how the heart functions properly. And it is something that begins to be imprinted by the mother's heart rate variability during the third trimester of pregnancy, when the fetal cardiovascular system is connected to that maternal cardiovascular system. And you have the heart rate variability, which is going to be different, of course, in a fetus, but it's being imprinted by the mother. So the whole heart rate variability is very important. And respiratory sinus arrhythmia, RSA. Now, RSA has to do with the relationship of the heart to the breath. I like to define RSA as every breath is different. The metabolic demands of the human body from moment to moment, from second to second, not only in terms of the oxygen required to run our bodies, but the glucose that's required and the proteins, the macronutrients and all that kind of thing, and the love and compassion that we need to function socially, all of that is being registered moment to moment. And consequently, our breath will change ever so slightly, you know, if it's to have a better demand for oxygen or to take a break if there's not that much of a demand for oxygen. But what's really important about respiratory sinus arrhythmia is that when you inhale, sympathetic tone goes up. When you exhale, parasympathetic tone goes up. It means you get better heart rate variability and you get better vagal tone in the exhalation. For those of you that are in the field of health and manual therapy, you know that breathing now is such a major thing that's being promoted everywhere. I tried to avoid working with the breath with my clients for many years, and it's unavoidable. We have people with their diaphragms wrapped up around their throat, and we've got to get the diaphragms down. And that's one of the major problems with the vagus nerve, is that when that diaphragm gets tight from the type of exercise we do, or if we're overweight and it creates too much tension through the diaphragm, or if there's a metabolic problem with the liver that tightens the fascial capsule of the liver that shortens the diaphragm, all of these dynamics, including the health of the lymphatic system, are very importantly linked into the vagus nerve, to the breath, and to the exhalation, such that there's a number of breathing techniques that I promote. One of them is called coherent breathing, which is an even, slow breath. And I also have seen recently what's called the 7-Eleven breath. Now, 7-Eleven is a series of convenience stores that we have here in America, but the 7-Eleven breath is 7 seconds of inhalation and 11 seconds of exhalation, okay? So just to say that we will be talking about the breath and working with the breath, as well as the diaphragm above and below. In particular, just know that the background of the multivagal model, the polyvagal model, is vagal tone, heart rate variability, every heartbeat is different, and respiratory sinus arrhythmia, every breath is different. Now, as we get into this series, we need to also talk about the new terminology. There's two new terms that we're going to be exploring, and it relates to the manual therapy that I teach that you'll be seeing at the end of each presentation. We'll be looking at photographs of how I teach coming into relationship with the vagus nerve. The first term is called vagal stimulation. Now, I'm sure some of you have heard that term, vagal stimulation. Vagal stimulation comes about through research that started about 10 years ago. And it's when a surgically implanted device is put around the collarbones, close to the vagus nerve above the aorta, and you can pass a device over it and it will stimulate the vagus nerve. And that originally was found to be good for conditions like multiple sclerosis. That was the original research on that. But nonetheless, vagal stimulation now turns out to be extremely valuable for the people that have inflammatory conditions, because the vagus nerve reports inflammation to the brain, and then the vagus nerve sends out anti-inflammatory signals. You can enhance those anti-inflammatory signals through vagal stimulation. And we're going to be looking at the places where you can stimulate the vagus the most, not only with your breath, with the exhalation, but also with your hands. So vagal stimulation, not only from the surgical point of view, but from the manual point of view. So I'm going to use vagal stimulation interchangeably, but it came from the research on the surgical end of it. Now, the other term that's important that we be familiar with is called vagal maneuvers. So vagal maneuvers. Vagal maneuvers is a term that came about from the literature on atrial fibrillation, so AFib, as it's called, when our cardiac nervous system in the atria starts misfiring and you get fibrillation in the atria, which is very uncomfortable, which should not go on more than 30 hours or you need to get to a hospital. And also, it should not elevate your heart rate over 100, or you really should go to the ER to get your heart rate lowered if you're in AFib. However, if you don't want to go to the hospital and you're still in that 30-hour mark, a lot of literature has come out now on what you can do at home to do a vagal maneuver. There's a lot of yoga that you can do, particularly inverted postures and inverted poses that turn the diaphragm upside down, and it creates a tension on the vagus nerve, and that helps to regulate the heart. That's just one such vagal maneuver, but there are many vagal maneuvers. I had AFib for 3 years, and so I got really good And the first two veneuvers that I learned about, and my wife thought I was stark, raving, lunatic mad. The first one is to drink ice cold water. Now, the vagus nerve innervates the back of the throat. It's responsible for swallowing. It innervates the epithelium of the throat. It's very much involved not only in swallowing, but in breathing and in speech and speaking. But apparently, if you can shock that vagus nerve with cold water by drinking it, sometimes that will regulate the heart. That didn't help. The part where my wife thought I was nuts is you take a big bowl and you fill it with ice and then water, and you wait until it's a Russian ice pond, you know, where you go ice fishing, and you stick your face right in this, because your whole face is a parasympathetic organ. And of course, the vagus nerve is all around here and down through here, and the other parasympathetic nerves. When my wife said, my wife thought I was bobbing for apples, and she said, "You're a little too old for that, aren't you?" I said, "No, it's just my heart, and I'm seeing if I can shock it back into regularity," or it's called conversion, convert the heart. So new terms, vagal stimulation, vagal maneuver. So I think the manual therapy I'm going to be showing you is very much about vagal stimulation or a vagal maneuver. And now you can go on the internet, and there's many, many YouTubes and discussions around different ways, different vagal maneuvers that you can do on your own to help stimulate the vagus nerve. So that's our terminology part. Our safety part. Now let's look at some images here. This is the chart that I put together. I know if you're looking at it on the screen, it probably looks pretty small. It's actually designed to be much larger. So just to say that this is the model that I'm going to be teaching from. All of you next week will receive a PDF of this, so that when you get around to next week, you can see it. And now I'm going to enlarge it, and I'm going to take you on a short tour. But then I want to move on. And the key thing right here is going to be looking at the boxes over here on the left. So social safety is the first type of safety. And we know that Stephen Porges calls that neuroception. That's another word for social safety. I'm using the word social safety. And that safety increases through mindfulness, and it's also the detector of what Porges calls defensive physiology. So it's really the way our brain, through the vagus nerve, is monitoring the safety outside, okay? So safety as we're perceiving it outside. Remember, when we go below the diaphragm, the vagus is perceiving safety on the inside of the body, okay? Outside, so two different kinds of safety. And actually, based on Sandra Bloom's work, I'm going to differentiate this into four kinds of safety, which is why we have four times together. So in our time together, we're going to look at the pharyngeal plexus and the laryngeal nerves, the carotid sinus. I just added these as the major anatomical landmarks. And you can see here the association that the vagus nerve has with memory, hearing, speech, and swallowing. When we get down to the level of the heart, the next level of safety here, I'm calling this compassion safety. And Stephen Porges has written a beautiful article on the relationship of the polyvagal model to compassion. And he's also written a beautiful article on the polyvagal model as it relates to love. And I think these are very important dynamics, because we want to have resilience. We need resilience to get our heart rate back down, to get our heart rate variability stable, and to be able to experience joy and love. But at the same time, it's very important that it's rare, if impossible, to get through life without the experience of some level of betrayal. And I'm just calling, for the sake of this model and this particular chart, that the way that the heart functions when it doesn't sense safety is when it feels betrayed. Interesting terminology. And so we see that the anatomy associated with that is aorta, lung, and heart, and the pulmonary, cardiac, aortic, the esophageal plexi. We're going to be looking at those in detail because that's what we can get our hands on. That's what we can influence with our hands. So I'll be showing you precisely where to place your hands to influence that. I'm not sure if everybody knows what the vagal bodies are. In some anatomy books, they're called the aortic bodies, but the vagal bodies are basically a cluster of vagal cells right on top of the aorta, right here by the sternoclavicular notch, right by the manubrium right here. And it's the vagal bodies are what register oxygen saturation in the blood. And we'll be getting more into that. So, and then we have this dotted line you can see right here. That is taking us below the level of the diaphragm. And you can see here that the chart says that only the dorsal vagus goes below the level of the heart diaphragm. So we know in the polyvagal model that it's all about the new vagus, the ventral vagus. But the below the level of the diaphragm, folks, let me tell you, it's all dorsal vagus. Yes, there's a little bit of ventral vagus below the diaphragm. But when you see in our time together over the next couple of weeks, how complicated this dorsal vagus is below the diaphragm, it's totally amazing. I call that embodiment safety. So if we look over on the left, embodiment safety, I do mention vagal stimulation. We now know that the majority of metabolic conditions in the body are because people are not eating real food. They're eating processed food or ultra processed food or too much of it. And this causes metabolic syndrome. As I said, 88% of Americans have a variation on metabolic syndrome or some level of pain in their gut. And we'll be talking about that. I think in Great Britain, you probably have a very high level also of metabolic syndrome, but not as high as us Americans. I tell you, Americans want to be first. They want to be first in everything, including bad health. Hate to say that about my country. So we have immune endocrine co-regulation. We have serotonin as the principal neurotransmitter in the gut. Peyer's patches are the principal component of the immune system. And of course, the way in which the vagus nerve is monitoring all of this, and it's monitoring insulin levels as well, and giving all this information back to the brain to fight inflammation. And finally, what we'll get to towards the end of these seminars in a couple of weeks is the domain of moral safety. Just for the sake of this chart, I put moral safety in the quadrant associated with the pelvis. But I do think there are other ways other than sexual abuse and abuse having to do with the pelvic floor that we have a lack of safety, but I just, for the sake of this chart, I put moral safety there. And I think it's important also to name, because I'm involved now, I'm a student in a Buddhist chaplaincy program. And so it's a lot about moral safety. And as you can see here, learning about moral violation and moral injury. The newer research that's coming out on post-traumatic stress disorder, trauma in general, is that it's being redefined in many cases, not all, but in many cases, as a moral violation that leads to a moral injury and consequently a lack of moral safety. The long and short of moral safety is, in moral injury in particular, people, what's the best way to say this? People have a hard time distinguishing between right and wrong. That's very, very deep lack of safety, okay? When you can't make those distinctions. So you'll be getting this chart. You'll also be getting this chart that I put together a couple of months ago. And this is the biodynamic perception of safety in the work I teach, which I now call biodynamic cardiovascular therapy, but it's a variation on the theme of biodynamic craniosacral therapy. But those four spheres of embodied safety that I just mentioned to you are here. And then here we have safety of body and mind, and mindfulness of relevant therapeutic phenomena, what to accept and what to reject. So when we feel safe in our body and mind, and when we can promote that and give that and support that in another person, we then develop the ability to know what to accept and what to reject, not only emotionally, but physically, as a foundation or one of the key elements of feeling safe and being able to express that, what to reject, very difficult with some people. And in the work of biodynamic practice, it's mindfulness of slowness and awareness of silence. So the whole notion of a slow tide being supported within the space of silence, and that we pause, we wait, we relax, and we develop a sense of compassion, tenderness, discriminating awareness, staying in the present moment. So all the buzzwords that we know about as therapists, and essentially just being able to express kindness. I think more than anything else, the greatest way that we can help another person feel safe is to express kindness, whether that's a smile on our face that activates our parasympathetic system, or the words that we choose to use with the client, or our facial expressions and body movement, tones of our voice, all of this that is being registered by the client in terms of safety. In each of these programs over the next several weeks, we're going to be looking at the breath, and we're going to be looking here at the anatomy of the breath. So we're looking at the anterior trunk wall right here. And let's look right down here. You can see the diaphragm, and this muscle right here that interdigitates with the respiratory diaphragm is the transversus thoracis muscle, okay? What does this mean and why is this important? Since the transversus thoracis that interdigitates with the diaphragm and also has origins on the crest of the ilium and on the lumbar fascia laterally, when you inhale, the belly comes out, and when you exhale, it naturally falls back. When the belly comes out, it stretches the vagus nerve. This is typically called belly breathing. So I talk about the inner breath, step one, finding the breath on the inside of your body, up and down your spine, into the lower lobes of your lungs, and then belly breathing, placing your hands over your umbilicus or below your umbilicus, between the umbilicus and pubic symphysis, and letting the breath come into contact with your hands so that that transversus thoracis can start expanding and rehabilitating itself and rehabilitating the vagal function, the dorsal vagal function below the level of the diaphragm. I kind of threw this one in for fun because I often get asked, well, isn't the vagus nerve associated with the Kundalini? Sure. It depends on which yoga book and which yoga teacher you're reading. But there has been that association since I went to massage school in the 1970s. It was one of the first books that came out was called Kundalini, Psychosis or Transcendence by a psychiatrist by the name of Sanella. And he talked about in that book, the overstimulation that was happening of what was considered to be the Kundalini at the time could have been overstimulation of the vagus nerve. But we see here I like this because here you can see the plexi associated with the vagus nerve. So the vagus nerve always comes together with the sympathetic nervous system in these plexi. So I've already mentioned the glossopharyngeal plexus or nerve, the pharyngeal plexus, the cardiac plexus and pulmonary plexus, the solar plexus and the hypogastric plexus, all of which we're going to be getting into some detail. I'm not going to be getting into detail about the Kundalini. This is not about the Kundalini, but it's a metaphor for the vagus nerve. Here's the vagus nerve. So we see here in blue, right here, the vagus nerve coming out of the brain stem and projecting forward into the face, into the cranium, into the tongue, into the throat. Here we can see the pulmonary and cardiac plexus. Down here, we can see the esophageal plexus, okay? And now we get below the level of the diaphragm and wow, look at that. Look at that vagus nerve. It just takes off and it innervates everything. I mean, this is one smart nerve and is sending a whole lot of information back up to the brain and back down, as I said. And this is not the vagus nerve here. This is the sacral outflow of the parasympathetic nervous system coming from your coccyx and sacrum. And when we get to that level of anatomy in that webinar, we're going to be going into this in some detail. But in humans, the vagus nerve terminates in the hypogastric plexi and in the distal portion of the transverse colon. Does not go down to the ovaries or the prostate as it does in rodents. We have here a look at the embryonic vagus nerve. So when you're about the size of a navy bean, you can see the vagus nerve here and it comes down and it comes down. Here's our diaphragm right here. And that vagus nerve and the dorsal component of it continues down into the subdiaphragmatic area, into the abdomen. And no wonder they call it the wandering nerve. The vagus nerve comes about in embryology from what are called neural crest cells right here. And these neural crest cells, they move forward through the neck. And that's why you have so many structures in the throat and neck that are innervated by the vagus nerve. And then the vagus nerve gets as far as the sinoatrial node in the heart and it goes no further. So this is where we get 70 beats a minute, vagal tone, with that sinoatrial node right in that general area right there of the embryo. The parasympathetic nervous system develops first in the embryo. We can see the heart developing here at about 3 weeks. And we have parasympathetic neurotransmitters that are already present. And then that moves into the development of the sympathetic system at week 5, back to the parasympathetic system at week 8 and 9, and then parasympathetic tone picking up much more in weeks 13 through 17. And finally, at the end of pregnancy, sympathetic tone being the major factor that gets us born and gets us the energy to get out of the womb develops mostly in the latter part of the third trimester of pregnancy. The point of this image here is that you have a sense that it's, first of all, it's parasympathetic first. Just understand that's the first part of the autonomic system to develop, then sympathetic. And it goes back and forth. And we see this when we, after birth, we see in the attachment dynamic with caregivers that we go back and forth with sympathetic development, approach behaviors, and then parasympathetic development with separation behaviors from caregivers. This is Nolte's neuro book, but just so you all remember, when I talk about the vagus nerve, dorsal and ventral, we can see right here that it's actually four nerves, two on the right side of the brainstem. So you have a dorsal and a ventral on the right and the left side of the brainstem. And this can be a point of confusion because both ventral and dorsal exit the jugular foramen in the cranium bilaterally. And here we can see it unilaterally, but just on one side. And we can generally see here the configuration through the jugular foramen. The superior and inferior ganglion, we'll talk about that later. These appear right at the entrance to the jugular foramen. There's some discussion in the literature about the differentiation of what information is being processed there. Is it emotional information? Is this where the differentiation of metabolic to physiological information takes place? There's a lot of discussion in the literature. I haven't seen anything quite definitive. That doesn't mean it isn't out there, given the nature of how much research comes out. However, I do like to mention that along with the brainstem and the development of the vagus nerve and the dorsal and ventral aspect, the older part, older than the vagus nerve, is the reticular formation. And I just wanted to make sure that I showed that to everyone. This is an important consideration because it's the reticular formation that's really probably well over 500 million years old in terms of the evolutionary development of the nervous system. And it's the reticular formation that makes the first differentiation into pleasure and pain, primarily because organisms are attracted to sensations that are nurturing, whether that's food or love or compassion, and they're naturally repulsed by that which isn't. So the underlying dynamic of safety is also linked to an older evolutionary structure in the human nervous system called the reticular formation. We see here in the polyvagal theory that regarding that information, one of the hallmarks of polyvagal theory is that when we have a reaction to a stressor, let's say, that our first reaction is we're going to feel safe. If we don't feel safe, the second reaction, which comes from a long time ago, is moderate to extreme danger, and that's the activation of the sympathetics. And then, of course, we know in the polyvagal theory that we can really zone out. We can go into a severe dissociative episode. We can go into death feigning. We can actually faint. Some interesting literature research on fainting that came out when they differentiated all this. But nonetheless, the whole idea here is that the newer parts of the system are going to respond first to a lack of safety or the felt sense of safety. And we keep going back in our evolutionary development when we don't have the resilience, when we don't have good vagal tone, when we don't have good heart rate variability, we start going way back and digging up these old patterns in the brain. And especially the dorsal vagus, very long time ago. Deb Dana just published a chart that made it to be like 500 million years ago is when this started. That's a long time ago. So it's an old reaction, so to speak. And it's a very primitive reaction. And it's the dorsal vagus that innervates and connects with everything in the gut. So below the level of the diaphragm, we have to understand how old our gut is, you could say, because it's not just the vagus nerve, it's the gut itself. So very important. I can't wait to talk about that. I think it's the third webinar. And safety. So we see that in this whole dynamic, the older response of non-safety, the freeze response, as it's called, and then we get into fight flight. And then we get into the blue zone here, the neuroception of the felt sense of safety. where we feel socially engaged, we can mobilize, and we have immobility without fear, okay? We can immobilize without fear. We can go to the bathroom and have a bowel movement or fully urinate. We can go in the bedroom and make love with our partner, and we can be immobilized without fear. So very, very important dynamics, whether you're a fetus, a baby, or an adult. Safety is the key component. We're going to be going over that later. Here we can see the vagus nerve as it comes down below the, and then only the dorsal comes below the level of the diaphragm. You can see it's in two parts. And then it mixes with the parasympathetic outflow, as I said here. We will be getting into some detail around this, and the hands-on positions that I'll be showing you shortly are really about locating the interface of where the vagus interfaces with the sympathetics in the plexi. That's a really key component for stabilizing the autonomic system within its vagal component. We know that the vagus nerve innervates the posterior cranial fossa, the dura mater, and that means that any of our work with the occiput as cranial therapists and biodynamically with the AO joint, with the occiput, that entire area, very, very important. Jugular foramen right here that we talked about where it exits. Back of the tongue, we can see here a netter where we have the different distribution of trigeminal nerve. But here at the very back of the tongue is where the vagus nerve begins. So if you can see that right here at the back of the tongue. And you know, some people, this is where you stimulate manually if you're sick with your fingers, and it's the vagus nerve that will help you throw up if you've eaten something that's upsetting your stomach. So here, back here, you can see the vagus nerve. So this is the where it begins actually structurally in the innervation that it does, especially the throat and the tongue. This is research that was done in Great Britain either last year or the year before. This is a device that's placed on the tragus of the ear, and it stimulates the vagus. And again, very positive anti-inflammatory effects, as I said. So one of the things I'm going to be showing you is just how to contact the tragus nerve, or the tragus as it's innervated by the vagus. Here you can see the distribution in the ear, very important, because contact with the ear is very important in cranial work. And you can see the vagus nerve in this general area and the glossopharyngeal, all right? And the facialis nerve, and then the back right here, down below here, the different trigeminal nerves. So the different cranial nerves around the ear. The ear becomes a very important organ for stimulating the vagus nerve, not just the tragus. Same slide. So it's the tragus right here that we want to have contact with. And the vagus comes all the way down underneath the sternomastoid in the carotid sheath. So when we're aiming our hands for contact, especially with the vagus nerve, we're either going to be using the posterior edge of the SCM or the anterior edge. And here we can see the vagus nerve as it comes down, and it goes, loops around under the aorta and comes back up into the anterior neck to the trachea and larynx and so forth. So all the techniques that I'm going to be showing you around the anterior neck are all for stimulating that vagus nerve and so forth. Now, I forgot to ask John or Julian, I'm going to pause now because I want to go into the hands-on position and just see if there's any quick questions before I look at the hand positions. I don't know if this is a good time to do that or we should wait until I get through with the end of the...
Michael, if I could ask you something about, because you mentioned about COVID and stuff, and it's something I've been very interested in terms of other things that might affect the vagus, particularly around the brainstem. I'm thinking that because they've linked like long COVID with perhaps one of the structures that it really affects is the vagus in terms of long COVID. But also things like restricted blood supply seems to affect it, bacterial things like Lyme's disease and other things. I'm just wondering if you've got any thoughts on that.
If you can reshape the question, I have a lot of thoughts on that, but I want to make sure I answer it. So give me the question.
It's just an area of interest because I think it's often overlooked. And I know there is a little bit of research around the vagus in terms of bacteria and viruses. And I suppose my question is, do you know of much research in this area? Because it seems to be overlooked.
I think basically, as I said, the vagus innervates everything. The vagus is monitoring the entire gut microbiome. So it has nerve endings in the microbiome. And since the microbiome is not only full of bacteria, but also viruses, it is sending information to the brain about the composition of healthy versus unhealthy bacteria, healthy versus unhealthy viruses. I do plan on showing a couple of research articles in one of the webinars, and I'll see or try to make sure that it discusses that so you can see that there is a little bit of literature on that. But yes, very much so the vagus nerve is involved in that, which is a reason why COVID would also be have such an effect on the vagus nerve.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think maybe I was thinking more of like how it structurally affects, like how a lack of blood supply might affect like the neural tissue or bacteria might affect the nerve tissue itself and affect the functioning of it.
It's not discussed as blood supply. It's discussed as the pro-inflammatory state in that in metabolic challenges, the endothelium of the cardiovascular system becomes inflamed. The inflammation starts in the epithelium of the gut, and then it goes through the vascular system to the liver. The liver then does a lot of hijinks to try to manage the inflammation, usually from the quality of food that's being eaten. And then depending on one's epigenetics, that inflammatory process, since it's systemic now within the blood supply and in the vascular system, there's going to be large patches of the endothelium, and it's not the same for everybody, but there's going to be large patches of the endothelium then that become inflamed. And as a result, those areas that are referenced by that particular location in the body and what organs that area is serving will then have a problem. So it's a very difficult problem because what happens is, and the literature keeps going back to the fact that in all of these cells, whether it's in the endothelium or the gut or the microbiome, almost every single cell in the human body has a cytokine receptor on it. And so consequently, those cytokine receptors, you get into what's called the COVID storm or the cytokine storm, because the inflammation is overwhelming the receptor sites that then of the cytokines, and then the cytokines get overwhelmed, and then they overwhelm the immune system in terms of its inability to function properly because it hasn't been functioning properly. So I don't know if that linkage I just mentioned helps you understand that.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Okay.
There's a question from Mar DeVille. She's asking, what is the relationship of the vagus with the cerebellum?
I don't know. I've not been asked that question. cerebellum so is associated with movement. And in the original research on vagal stimulation, it was for musculosclerosis, but then those lesions might not be in specifically the cerebellum. So short answer, I can't answer that because I don't know. Sorry.
Great. I think that's it for the minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me, I'm going to scoot forward here. Here we go. I usually like to start this this work with the vagus nerve. Now let me rephrase that. What I'm showing you is going to be a top-down approach. But I usually start, you know, holding the feet like a lot of cranial therapists do, you know, just to get a sense of the body. It's very rare for me to start at the head. So I just want to say that as we look at these images now, I'm not recommending that you start at the head and this be the first thing you do. I'm thinking, yes, you can use what I'm showing you as a protocol that would fit in the middle of what you're already doing. Okay, so very want to be very clear about that. And also, you don't have to use it as a protocol. There has to be a point at which you graduate from protocol. I think there should be a point that you graduate from protocols and you enter into the therapeutic relationship of not knowing, but you just enter that relationship and then are guided by the relationship, which means anything I'm showing you here with these photos and any of the webinars are going to be used anytime, any place you want. So just to say that, as a student, I would always mimic the protocol I learned in a class for about a week and a half on every client, and then gradually got away from it. And I just filtered through the best ones that at that point in my career, I was enjoying the best and the clients were getting results from. I hope that makes sense. So I really consider this to be an advanced seminar. You can see my fingers here behind the neck. They're spanning the spinous processes of C3 up to the occiput. My pinky is actually on the occiput, and I call this the heart fulcrum. This is where the vagal neural crest cells begin. Okay, so a bilateral contact, the fingers come together. I'm on pause now because I'm getting a sign that there's a meeting that's over. So
Sorry, we've lost Michael. I'm sure he'll find his way back with a link. So for those of you joining on Facebook, Michael's introducing his 3-part course that will begin next week at the same time, 7 p.m. UK time, and going through some of the detail. You may have received the email and be joining us in Zoom, and hopefully we'll get Michael back, won't we, John, shortly?
Yeah. And just to say a few things, other things coming up while we're waiting for Michael. Oh, here.
Sorry about that.
He's back. Great.
It's funny. Not funny. It's like, oh my God, what happened? But my wife is also doing a Zoom in the other part of the house.
Oh,
and
okay.
So part of what was coming up was that, never mind. Here we are.
Here we are. Fantastic.
So as I was saying, before my wife rudely interrupted me, not really. So we have the heart fulcrum where the vagal neural crest cells come from. And then we have a contact here. Now notice that my two hands are different. My left hand, I have a finger right here on the styloid process. This is the closest you're gonna probably get to the vagus nerve in the neck, in the carotid sheath that's attached to the styloid process. But on the other side right here, my finger is in the occipital mastoid suture, which is influencing the jugular foramen, okay? So what I'm recommending, and you'll get copies of all these photographs, but what I'm recommending here is that we're doing ipsilateral work. So one finger on styloid, one finger on the OMS, and then of course you reverse that and you do both sides, but not at the same time, okay? Very, very important to stimulate. This is a picture of my wife before we were married 31 years ago. I like showing this because I didn't know I was teaching the heart fulcrum back then. But as we were falling in love with each other, I just really enjoyed putting my hands there. So it's kind of organically coming into the heart fulcrum. Again, and I just want to say that these techniques I'm showing you are from French osteopathy. These are ipsilateral techniques. We have a contact right here in the area of the carotid sinus, right here. So again, I placed the pad of my middle finger right over the belly of the sternomastoid, right in the middle of it. Don't worry about, the anatomy of where is the carotid sinus located. It's at the bifurcation of the internal and external carotid artery from the main carotid artery. That's where the sinus is. It's about halfway up. All you have to know is that general area in the belly, the middle of the SCM. And my other finger here is right in the notch of the manubrium, right here. And so in that notch is where the vagal bodies are located. And again, we're going to reverse that so that you can have an opportunity to do both sides. So you can see reversing right here, me doing the other side. Now, I want to make sure that you're not seeing me using a prop here, but on the other side, there is a prop that you can see right here. In the work I teach, it's exceedingly important to have props for your arms and hands, because I teach a lot of this delicate work with the nerves and the arteries, and to be able to have a steady hand is very, very important. And there's our tragus right there of the ear. And there's a bilateral contact with the tragus. Very similar, as you can remember, to the Upledger temporal ear pull, where you actually have contact with the bigger part of the ear. And knowing now that any of those techniques you do for the ear are going to be very, very stimulating for the vagus nerve, if you work gently, as gently as possible. Here at the tragus nerve, you can generally also get a sense of the rotation of the temporal bones, all of that we typically know and work with, you can get right from the tragus. And it's an amazing contact, I'll tell you. The feedback I get from clients is totally amazing. It's not a pinch, it's a light contact in terms of biodynamics. So that's very, very important. And just wanted to make sure everybody knows where the occipital mastoid suture is located. So right between the temporal and the occiput, it's one of my favorite go-to places. Roland Becker said, and I'll never forget it, early in my career, the occipital mastoid suture is the most important suture in the cranium. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And this is where V-spread technique developed, of using the V-spread through the two occipital mastoid sutures. But this is the gateway to the vagus nerve. That's probably, what he was feeling in his work. And if you can get a sense of that occipital mastoid suture and the occiput breathing within that contact, it'd be a wonderful thing for your client, wonderful. And of course, the styloid process, pointing out the location of the styloid process. Now, you don't have to palpate the styloid process. It's got a lot of nerves and it can be quite painful. You just need to know where it is and kind of sneak up on it a little bit. It's covered by a lot of connective tissue, but just to get a general sense of its location without having to drill in for to have physical contact with it. So just be very gentle, please, around that, because the carotid sheath that houses the jugular vein, the carotid artery, and the vagus nerve in one sheath, one fascial sheath, is attached to that right there. And it goes underneath the sternomastoid. So those are our two points, the styloid and the occipital mastoid suture. And that's the contact with the occipital mastoid suture. Any finger is okay. Again, you don't have to do it the way I do it. If you've already got a contact that you make either ipsilaterally, as we showed a couple of photos earlier, or bilaterally, just make sure you contact it, please. And finally, I do like to work with the AO joint. So this is the AO joint contact that I'm making so that the pads of my fingers are up against the occiput. And the tips right here are really aiming for that space between the second cervical vertebra. And here's the key thing for me, because I know all of you do the AO, or most of you do it. And that is the key component here is wait until your fingers feel the pulsation of the vertebral artery. Just wait. And once you feel the pulsation of the vertebral artery, then you'll start to feel the developmental motion of the occiput under your hand. Of course, you'll feel a lot of tension in that suboccipital area release, hopefully, but wait for the vertebral artery, okay? 20% of the blood supply going to the brain is coming through that vertebral artery and into the brain and dura. Another AO. And there we have a view now from the side. And I have to say that the AO, since the beginning of my cranial career, which was, how should we say this, 1984 is when I took my first cranial class, I love the AO joint. I think everybody for 20 years got at least two or three AO joint releases in every session. It's amazing, amazing. And I still work with this. If I don't do the heart fulcrum that I showed you first is a variation on this AO. I'm gonna save those last few for next time because I notice that our time is over. And I think you've seen a lot and I think you've heard a lot. In the next week, we're going to be looking more specifically at the anterior neck, as you just saw in that one photo, and techniques for that, and also the heart. And we're gonna be talking about and looking at the anatomy of the neck and heart in the next presentation, actually a week from today. So I'm gonna stop sharing and let's see if there's any questions.
Cool, thank you. Thanks very much, Michael, that's wonderful. Mariel is asking, which French osteopath are you referring to? You talked about.
Oh, dang! I knew I didn't ask that. Actually, what I'll do is I'll send an email to my friend who knows, who studied with him. It's not Baral, so, and it's not what the other famous ones. So it's a relatively unknown French osteopath. But let me make a note here, and I'll find out.
B is asking, what is the AO joint? So the occipital anterior joint, right?
Correct.
Okay, cool. Right. I'm just wondering, Michael, we've had Stanley Rosenberg on before, and you know his book, and he talks a lot about sort of self-help techniques and some of those holds, which I've done instinctively over the years, and it's quite nice to put us in a reason why. But how many of those can you do yourself, you know, as a sort of like... ways of stimulating your vagus?
I think whatever is possible. I find myself, I do I do the ear work and the tragus work, but I do a lot of breath work. So I have a hand over the vagal bodies and then a hand over my lower abdomen. Mm. And so that's the main vagal stimulation work that I do. I also get a lot of, we have so many day spas around here that I do like getting facials because I know it's good for my parasympathetic system. But those are the main ones I do. I think you can do any of them. However, as a cautionary note, if you're laying in bed or you're trying to work with a suture and you don't know the weight and the angle, all of a sudden you could induce a lesion into the cranial system. And since I've done that before to myself, I tend to stay away from that. And I can tell you in the early days, and I'm... the early days being like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I would have students try all these techniques, the 10-step protocol on themselves after smoking dope. And they would come in the next day and their head looked like a parallelogram and it would take all day to get it back to normal again. So be careful with how you use this information and just get a felt sense. Of when it's too much.
Cool. All right. So Mike Michael's course is starting next Monday at 7 p.m. UK time. And the multivagal system in clinical practice. And so please have a look at our website, embodiedhealthlearning.com, and look for the short courses there. So please do join us for that starting next Monday. Tomorrow, I'm going to be hosting a webinar with Dr. Carol Davis, and we're going to be bringing some of this material in, and we're going to be talking about empathy and referring to some of Stephen Porges's work around compassion and empathy. Now, that's tomorrow at 7 p.m. Wednesday, we have Kathy Dooley coming back for her second part of the pelvic floor course, which is really wonderful. If you want to join us for that, that's on Wednesday. And on the 15th of February, we have Nick Totten going to be running a course for us. Nick is a wonderful, pioneering psychotherapist. So thank you, Michael, very much. And thank you, everybody, for being here.
Yep. John, Julian, I will send you the PDFs of the handouts for the people that register for next Monday. I'll get them to you by the end of the week.
Great. And we'll put the registration in the chat as well right now. Julian, is that okay?
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Michael. See you next
week. See you next Monday.
See you next Monday. Perfect.
Thank you, Michael. See you next week.
Bye. Love you guys. Great job.
Bye.